Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 97, Christmas Stories. A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas. A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote. And Duel in the Snow or Red Rider Nails the Cleveland Street Kid by Gene Shepherd. Welcome to episode 97 of Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that's brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether or not it is required reading. And it is that time of year again. Yes, folks, it's that time where Stella complains that I once again have the December episode and curses to the high heavens because I am picking the Christmas themed thing. So,
it's true.
She's plastered on eggnog. I have my glue vine. We're gonna get all festive up in here because we really need it at this point. So, how are you?
Hey, yeah, I'm taking it a day at a time, trying to make it. And yeah, it's kind of in the thick of things. You imagine that around Thanksgiving that things will even out. But number one, it's making it to Thanksgiving because it's a long push. Yeah. I didn't get a fall break. And then you have like exams and things and like report card comments to make. So it's
really
a lot going on at the moment. But yes, here we are. And the weather here, I don't know what it's doing down there in Seville, is fluctuating. Yeah. So, I've got a warm day one day. I've got a chilly day the next day.
Yeah, no, it's been like that here too. And then so my schedule between Election Day and Christmas break or winter break is 3 weeks and 3 weeks. So I had 2 weeks last, 2 days last week, two full weeks and a 3 days last week, two full weeks and a 2 day week and then Thanksgiving and then 3 weeks and then Christmas. What is yours like that or?
Yeah, three days off for Thanksgiving and then I think 2 weeks and then Christmas break. Yeah.
So not too bad. I mean, it's tough because yeah, you're right. You make it to Thanksgiving, but then that week, the time between Thanksgiving and Christmas, you actually need to do stuff. And it's sometimes really hard to keep your head in the game because you're just like, when is this holiday going to get here?
Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah, so we actually have three stories. So this is something new. We have not done this yet. We've played with different genres. We've read all sorts of things. But everything we've read so far, I think, if I'm not mistaken, has been like a full-length work, right? It's been like a novel or a full-length play.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, because we have yet to do The Things We Carried.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have yet to do Flannery O'Connor. So, yeah, I believe it.
Yeah, I actually bought a Flannery O'Connor short story collection
Ooh.
At the
book sale.
Book sale. Yeah, the library sale. So that was pretty cool. So this is actually, it's three short, like essay / short stories, because they are autobiographical or semi-autobiographical on the part of each writer. And they are in that they are part of a, they were maybe included in a collection somewhere. They were published in a magazine or something at some point. The two of them are not incredibly long. The third one, the Gene Shepherd one, is, you know, it's probably a good 15 or 20 pages of a larger book. But we haven't done this yet. And the, so I'm a huge fan of the nonfiction narrative, of the personal essay, of the autobiographical essay. One of my favorite writers ever is E.B. White, who wrote Charlotte's Web, of course, and we talked about Charlotte's Web. But one of my favorite things about E.B. White was the essays that he wrote for, like The New Yorker and Harper's and Collier's and all these different magazines that he worked for, where he was writing about just kind of everyday life and things and commentary on society at the time. And, you know, I always liked his style, but I always liked that sort of thing, the humor of it. And then there's other essayists out there. A current one that a lot of people will be very familiar with, be like David Sedaris and such. So I have a long history of reading and then writing or attempting to write these types of essays and stories. Have you had a lot of experience with this type of, with this particular like genre?
I'll say yes, because I'm sure academically that I've read certain things like this. I can't really put my finger on what that might be. But like short stories in general, I have a good experience with Flannery O'Connor. I took a Southern like race. What was it? Like race, gender, and something in the South. My first year at UVA as an NWAR class. And that there were many short stories that we read. But something that felt like this, that it was memoir-ish short stories, I would say that maybe not as much.
Yeah, I could think of the only thing that I know for sure that we have both read that has this sort of format, but it's a far larger book, would have been Paul Feig's Kick Me, only because I lent you my copy.
Oh, right.
which is actually one of my favorite books of this nature. Yeah, no, I think at one point you and I or one of us will do a sort of short story episode where we maybe both pick a story or one of us picks a couple of stories like this. Because, yeah, short stories themselves, like the fiction ones, I'm all over, partially as a teacher, right? Because, you know, I use them in class and stuff like that. And then partially because there are some really, really great ones out there. So, but yeah, so this is really cool. And you know, it's an older form that, you know, it goes back to the, like, White was writing in the early 20th century, like the 20s, 30s, 40s, and into the mid-century. And, you know, there are people who wrote before him. And it evolved over the years. There are still these published in magazines. But, you know, we had the age of blogging back in the early 2000s, which was a much shorter form of this and stuff like that. And, yeah, so I was excited for this, and I've used at least one of these in class years ago. I used the Dylan Thomas piece a long, long time ago, but I haven't used either of these or so. And so we're going to take a slightly different format with this episode.
How could you?
I know. But it's my show, and when you could,
my show.
Well, whoa. it's my episode, right? I'm the one who picked it. That's what I meant. So
now it's coming out. When you pick 97 episodes later, that this is the reason why your name was first, because you were gradually taking control of it.
Let me have this. when you get your episode up and you want to change the format, you can. But no, and I thought it would be easier to just have a better flow and maybe easy for everybody listening to understand or follow was that we are going to do each of the stories individually with author background summary and questions. And then after we finish the third one, I do have a small set of questions that encompass all three of them. So that way we can kind of compartmentalize and segment this out. And we're going to start with the earliest one, and that is the Dylan Thomas story, A Child's Christmas in Wales. And I'm going to go ahead and give you guys a little bit of information about who Dylan Thomas was, as well as the background on the story and our usual plot synopsis. Dylan Thomas, famous Welsh poet, born on October 27, 1914. He died on November 9, 1953. He was only 39 years old when he died. He was born in Wales, lived in England, traveled all over the place, including America and New York City specifically. Through his short life, he completed a wealth of work, including hundreds of poems, surreal short stories, beautiful broadcasts about his childhood, a novel, a play for voices, and all of which were written before he was 40. And I should say that my sources for the bio information and background on Child's Christmas in Wales are discoverdylanthomas.com, which has a really much lengthier bio page and site about him, as well as filling in with Wikipedia too. So Thomas came to be appreciated as a popular poet during his lifetime, although he found earning a living as a writer pretty difficult, which it tends to be. He began augmenting his income with reading tours and radio broadcasts. His radio recordings for the BBC during the late 1940s brought him to the public's attention, and he was frequently featured by the BBC as an accessible voice of the literary scene. Thomas first traveled to the United States in the 50s. His readings there brought him a degree of fame, while his erratic behavior and his drinking worsened. During his fourth trip to New York in 1953, he became gravely ill and fell into a coma and died on November 9th. His body was returned to Wales on November 25th. He was interred at St. Martin's Churchyard in, oh God, Loughran, Carmarthenshire? Carmarthenshire. No, anyway. You Brits and your long-ass names. Anyway, although Thomas wrote exclusively in the English language, he has been acknowledged as one of the most important Welsh poets of the 20th century. He's noted for his original, rhythmic, and ingenious works, use of words and imagery. His position as one of the great modern poets has been much discussed, and he remains popular with the public. Now, A Child's Christmas in Wales was first conceived in the 1940s as a BBC recording titled Memories of Christmas. And these were combined into an essay form and first published in 1947 for the Picture Post. It was titled Conversation About Christmas at the time. Harper's Bazaar gave the story its currently known title when they published it in 1950. On his 1952 tour of America, Thomas was visited at the Chelsea Hotel by college graduates Barbara Holdridge and Marianne Roney, who believed that there were commercial possibilities in the U.S. for recordings of poetry. After previously finding little interest from American backers in medieval music and Shakespeare recitals, the women had turned to the recording of contemporary authors reading their own works, so kind of the early audiobooks. Thomas agreed to make a 45-minute LP and an initial fee of $500 for the first 1,000 records sold, as well as 10% royalty thereafter. Holdridge and Mantell were unable to find an interest in publishing company, so they were forced to pay his initial fee, and contract for that purpose was drawn up between them and Catamom Records, which was the name of the women's company. On the 22nd of February 1952, Thomas recorded five of his poems. In the White Giant's Thigh, Fern Hill, his most famous poem, which is Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, which I use in my AP English class, Ballad of the Long-Legged Bait, and Ceremony After a Fire Raid. When they asked him what he would use to fill up the LP's B-side, rather than more poetry, Thomas preferred a story. He could not remember its actual title and said that what he wanted to read, as he phrased it, A Child's Christmas in Wales. On the day of the recording, Thomas arrived at the studio without a copy of his story. A copy of Harper's Bazaar from 1950 containing the text had to be found for his reading. Rooney later stated that she believed Thomas may have been drunk during the recording. It sold modestly at first, but went on to become successful and one of his most loved works, launched Cadman into being a successful company. And as it stands with The Child's Christmas in Wales, and you'll hear this kind of through quite a bit of this episode concerning the summaries of these works, there's really not much of a plot here. It's kind of a rambling collection of memories that Thomas weaves together as if he's talking to an audience that definitely includes children, because I will say at one point he incorporates a dialogue with a boy who has presumably been listening to the story and interrupts him to ask questions and get him to move along when Thomas is stuck on a topic that the kid doesn't really care for. The essay begins with the phrase, "One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the sea town corner now. Out of all the sound except the distant speaking of the voices, I sometimes hear a moment before sleep that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and six nights when I was 12 or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was six." It's much cooler if you hear Dylan Thomas read it because he has the booming voice like Orson Welles or something like that. So. Anyway, that really sets for the tone of the story. He jumps from memory to memory throughout the Christmas day as if they were coming to him in a kind of a stream of consciousness. There's a story about his neighbor, Mrs. Prothero, and how he and his friend Jim had to call the fire brigade to help put out a fire that had started in her kitchen. There's another story about him encountering a kid he didn't like and then blowing whistles at one another. There's a rundown of the types of presents he got, both the useful and the fun presents. Meals served, and more than one story of an aunt or uncle's behavior after a hearty, alcohol-filled Christmas dinner. The uncles, for instance, are shown sleeping in big chairs, but there's also one story of an aunt who gets drunk and sings in the backyard like a big-bosomed thrush. Thomas ends the story with the end of the night, recounting music that was played and sung, and finishes with, "Looking through my bedroom window out into the moonlight and the unending smoke-colored snow, I could see the lights in the windows of all the other houses on our hill and hear the music rising from them up the long, steadily falling night. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness, and then I slept." And that is Dylan Thomas. That is A Child's Christmas in Wales. Again, a brief summary. And we have about maybe like 10 questions or so about it. So before we get to those, did you like this piece?
Yeah, I think of the three, this was my least favorite, to be honest. Part of it was, a bit jarring for me to follow. Mm-hmm. But then when I stood back and I was like, actually, this is kind of like how a child talks, where there are non sequiturs and they go off on little rabbit trails or they change topics entirely. And another time, like, okay, well, that kind of fits with A Child's Christmas in Wales. So framing it in that way, I think made it a bit better. So I would say yes, but of the three, this was my least favorite.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I've always really liked this because I find it to be kind of like comfort food as far as writing this stuff is concerned. I'll get into like the mood and some of the other things. I agree with you on the narration of the child, and funny how he even gets interrupted by a kid, right? Who's like, get to the point, pops. But yeah, and having, we've both been around enough children who will do this type of story thing. It's like, you know, I'm A to B to C to D, and then I'm on G, but then I'm back to C, you know, like, so this is, and such. So it is kind of a ramble, and things. Now I sent you, cause the recording of Thomas is available on YouTube and I think it's about like 19, 20 minutes long. And I sent you the link to it and you said you had listened to it. What did you think of the recording?
I enjoyed it. I think it's interesting because when I read, I think my mental voice is pretty probably monotone and not a lot of inflection unless the author is actually giving me exclamation points or all capitals or italics, because I'm just kind of reading for information and meaning, not necessarily emphasis or feelings, because I can intuit the feelings from what is being said. But when you have the author read his, her, or their own writing, it's really interesting because you get those inflections. And I think maybe you better understand intent of what they were writing and why they were writing it. So I enjoyed it. I thought that it was very nice. I was also quite impressed that because, you know, you're going to edit this, obviously, but you messed up a couple times.
Yeah.
And I mess up, you know, and I do synopses, and that's the magic of editing. But this man did not flub up once.
Yeah.
In a nearly 20-minute recitation of his work, which I thought was quite impressive.
Yeah. I would also highly recommend, from that same record, listening to him do recite Do Not Go Gentle into that Good Night. I do play it in AP Lit. I love it. It's because I like his voice. He has, like I said, that booming, almost deep voice that, like, you would associate with somebody like an Orson Welles, right? Or somebody who, and it's a great narrative voice. And you're right. The fact that you can hear it, and you can hear the different intention and inflection in things, especially when it is something like poetry, right? And this isn't poetry per se, but or sometimes prose. And when you are hearing the original writer, they can put that energy into it because they knew what their intent was. And I agree with you there. It's really smooth too, right? He just kind of smoothly goes through the whole thing. And so now, and I've heard that recording enough times. Because years ago with sophomores, I used to do this right around December, and we used to just kind of look at it as a piece of memoir, and I would play the recording. So when I read the story now, I hear his voice in my head. So, but, you know, you're talking about, like, the structure of it was back and forth, et cetera. It is kind of all around the place. It has a chronology of, it does kind of follow the track of, like, day to night, and it does end at the end of Christmas night, but it is just kind of like he says, I don't know if it was like all the Christmases kind of glommed together. What did you think of, like, putting aside kind of all the way it's structured and stuff, what did you think of, like, the language? Because he uses a lot of poetic language. And it's very, very flowy. It's very – it's not succinct. It's flowery in places.
Sure.
Where do you think that enhances, and where do you think that might hinder the story?
I think it enhances setting the scene with the imagery overall. Where it might hinder, I think it, I was going to say it can't necessarily continue with the quotations, but now I'm reading with sprinkling eyes and wind cherry noses on spread frozen feet. So I guess it can. I guess the only thing that I could say, because I think maybe overall it just enhances, is that if this is a child's memory, that it could be slightly it might be hard to believe. However, we do also have to realize that this is an adult looking back upon a child's memory. So I think that's the only thing is, if we're supposed to really feel like this is a child's perspective, I think we might imagine a child wouldn't necessarily speak like this. But otherwise, I feel like you really get a sense of this time and this place and this magical feeling, and with the snow and the holiday itself and the gifts and all of that. So, yeah, it flows quite well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I really love how he uses his abilities as a poet, especially with the scene setting and the imagery. Like, you know, it is really vivid, and you get a lot of feeling of in the piece. I mean, maybe the only places it hinders is where he does get into some really granular stuff about presence and things, and he kind of starts to ramble off, but and this kind of goes to the next thing. I think this is where he is pretty deft in the storytelling by bringing in this little voice of this young boy. He's like, and then the boy says, essentially like get to the point. But here a small boy says it snowed last year too, and I made a snowman and my brother knocked it down. So it becomes this conversation in the middle of it. And I think sometimes that voice of the boy who is supposed to be like the kid, it's like, I imagine like the grandson or the son or the relative, the young kid he's talking to is calling him out for just rambling on. And I think I really like, it's almost like a self-awareness in the narration that I really liked. And I also thought, what did you think of the whole thing with the conversation with the boys? Like, were there uncles and was there snow and all these things? I mean, did you think that worked?
Yeah. I don't know. Well, it just is interesting. I mean, does it start off this way?
No, the whole...
I guess that's the only issue is, like, could you be consistent, ?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like I said, those were the moments that I was kind of, like, pulled out of what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Were there uncles, like, in our house?
Yeah.
And trying to figure out what's going on. So I guess yes or no. I mean, I like how you explain it. I like that your insight into that. I thought it was a bit odd, but if that was his intent to kind of have that breaking in, that he was going off, because those are rather large paragraphs that he's just going listen.
Yeah.
And children's attentions in general are rather short.
Yeah, it's like, get on to the useless presents.
Yes. The other scene I wasn't sure about was that, I don't know, was it a bully who was like, had a cigarette?
Yeah.
And a black eye, and he was like ready for a fight, but then it didn't transpire. And I thought, why is that in here? What's happening?
I think it's like, you know, I guess that's his, him running around and running into the kid he didn't like, and then blowing their whistles against each other. And then all of a sudden we're just going to go on. So it is the kind of, for me, it's like, that's the really odd scene. Like, I don't know what the point was of that, unless it's just, again, a random memory of an encounter of some sort, because he does have other kids who his friends are with him here and there, so maybe it's just kind of like this was this other kid, but nothing really seems to become of it. But like I thought the dialogue between him and his friends was very authentic to kids. If you go to that part right after this part we were just talking about, of the bully and stuff, where they were saying, like, you know, they would pad through the street leaving huge footprints. He's like, I bet people think there'll be hippos. What would you do if you saw a hippo? I'd go like this. And what you saw the two, or earlier in the story where they have the fire and they're like, let's call the fire brigade. And Ernie Jenkins, he likes fires. And these people. And they are like excited little kids. And I thought that was really authentic as far as some of the storytelling was concerned. Now, I guess some of the question is, because like I said, these discussions of these stories that we're going to have are not going to be very long. And I think maybe some of the other stories might have more discussion to them. I think out of the three, this is the lightest, so to speak, as far as substance. I would imagine that we'll probably get a little more of the Capote story and maybe even the Gene Shepherd piece, but I think definitely the Capote story will probably have a little bit more discussion to it. But one question I have, and this is going to come up in a couple places, the reliability of the narrator. So he's telling a story about his childhood, yet I don't get the sense that he is completely reliable in terms of his memories. And I think he tries to use that to his advantage. I mean, like, what's your take on him as whether or not he's being a fully reliable narrator for us?
Could you give me an example of a section you don't trust?
not like a trusty thing. It's like, it's just that that intro part
I can never remember
if it snowed 6 days and nights. And then like, and then later on where they're talking about the snow and the kid said the snow here, right when he introduces the kid, he says, but here a small boy says it snowed last year too. And his reply is, but that was not the same snow. Our snow is not only shaken from whitewash buckets down the sky. It came shawling out of the ground and swam and drifted out of the arms. In other words, like uphill the bull snow, like a nostalgia-laden story about the snowfall, which was much more massive than it is now. Like, you know, that sort of thing. So clearly there's an unreliability because of the way he's looking at it through nostalgia. How does he make that work to his advantage?
Yeah, well, this is a question that I think we ask all the time with memoirs, because and even autobiographies, because to what extent are they actually recalling the information or discussions and things like that? And I think I like that section where he, you know, he's not sure. So it's both in its honesty. I think you almost feel like he's reliable because he's stating straight out that, you know, I sometimes misremember things, but also because it's Christmas and Christmas is such a holiday that I think we often recall pretty well. Because special things usually happen. And even people who have terrible Christmases, they're definitely going to remember that as well. Yeah. So I feel like because he's talking about that holiday in particular, I'm able to believe that he's more reliable. But even if not, I think that's maybe why the kid is there. That could be another reason, because the kid is questioning. And then maybe he has to kind of scratch his memory bank to figure out the answer to the child's question.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And I will add that one of the other things about Christmas when it comes to this unreliable narrator and all these things is that, you know, it is special. We remember it. But there's also like a lot of families who celebrate Christmas, or really any holiday, but let's just stick with Christmas, have traditions, right? So there's something that you do almost as a routine every year, you know, and it might be something little like, my parents used to make us sit at the top of the stairs until everything was ready. And then my mother would take a picture of us sitting at the top of the stairs. Or like you, we would always go to my grandmother, my dad's mom for Christmas Eve, you know, like those sorts of things. So like when he gets into the back half of this and he's talking about the aunts, the uncles and such, it's not a specific Christmas. It's more of just like, this is kind of how it always was. And I think he fully acknowledges that. And I really liked that about it because it feels authentic to me that, like, you know, we always had the uncles and they would always do this. And my aunt, you know, there was always that one aunt who was like this. And it does start with this very specific story about a fire, which is kind of a funny anecdote. But it goes on to be very much like, I think the audience on some level can identify with him because of the way he talks about the presents and the aunts and the uncles and the dinner and everything, because like, I think a lot of us reading this have something similar.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's one of the ways it holds up. I think the point is essentially just a fun Christmas memory. The point is humor as well. Does the humor work for you?
Yeah, I think it's there also, I feel like, people in the UK also have a different sense of humor, maybe.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I certainly got it, especially I think maybe more so once I was listening to him say it. Because when you're first reading this and they're talking about super excited to hit cats with snowballs, you're like, are they sociopaths? And then they get super excited that there's a fire because they can use all their snowballs to put the fire out. In reading it, you're like, huh? But then when he is speaking, you're like, oh, okay. So it is a bit silly.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then, yeah, the silly questions that the kid asks about the two hippos.
Yeah.
So yes.
And some of the descriptions of the aunts and the uncles and stuff are humorous too. They're almost cartoonish, right? Yes. And I really, really like that too. He just uses the language really to his advantage. And then the last question is just essentially the mood. The mood of this piece, and we don't talk about mood often, but this really has a mood of, it's charming. And it, by the end of it, it feels to me very cozy and comfortable. Did you feel the same way? Like when he is in the end and the fire is dying down, it's kind of like, I feel like he creates that mood very, very well toward the very, very end of the story.
Yeah, and they're singing Christmas carols. Yeah. Good King Applesauce. yeah, no, it sounds quite lovely. And what a beautiful way, you know, for people to come together than by... what is a more beautiful way than for people to come together and sing some carols?
Yeah, yeah. It's very gentle. In the same way that I find Vince Guaraldi's Charlie Brown Christmas album gentle, or Nat King Cole's Christmas album gentle and cozy and comforting and things like that. So all three of these in some way or another have something that I think is makes them timeless. And we'll get to that later. But if you're okay with it, I'll move on to a Christmas memory.
Sure thing.
So my bio for Truman Capote comes from PBS, who did an American Masters episode about him a number of years ago. I trimmed it down significantly. Throughout his career, Truman Capote remained one of America's most controversial and colorful authors, combining literary genius with a penchant for the glittering world of high society. Though he wrote only a handful of books, his prose styling was impeccable, and his insight into the psychology of human desire was extraordinary. His flamboyant and well-documented lifestyle has often overshadowed his gifts as a writer, but over time, Capote's work will outlive his celebrity. Born in New Orleans in 1924, Capote was abandoned by his mother and raised by his elderly aunts and cousins in Monroeville, Alabama. As a child, he lived a solitary and lonely existence, turning to writing for solace. He was a lifelong friend of Harper Lee and is said to be the basis for the character Dill in To Kill a Mockingbird. With literary success came social celebrity. The young writer was lionized by the high society elite and was seen at the best parties, clubs, and restaurants. He really was a, like, celebrity writer and a kind of gadfly man about town type from what I've read and what I've seen in various, documentaries and clips and things. Not about him, but about, like, just kind of, like, places, eras and things like that. So anyway, one of his most famous works of fiction is the short novel Breakfast at Tiffany's. It took much of his inspiration from these experiences of partying in society, and with the publication of Breakfast at Tiffany's and the subsequent hit film starring Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard, Capote's popularity and place among the upper crust was assured. His ambition, however, was to be great as well as popular, so he began work on a new experimental project that he imagined would revolutionize the field of journalism. In 1959, Capote set about creating a new literary genre, the, quote, nonfiction novel, and in the subgenre of what would now be called true crime. His extensive investigation into and interviews with the perpetrators of the murder of a family in Kansas led to 1966's In Cold Blood. In Cold Blood sold out instantly and became one of the most talked about books of its time. An instant classic, it brought its author millions of dollars as well as notoriety. To celebrate the book's success, Capote threw what many call the Party of the Century, the famous black and white ball. This mass ball at New York's Elegant Plaza Hotel was to be the pinnacle of both his literary endeavors and his popularity. Overwhelmed by the lifestyles of the rich and famous, Capote began to work on a project exploring the intimate details of his friends. He received a large advance for a book which was to be called Answered Prayers. The book was to be a biting and largely factual account of the glittering world in which he moved. The publication of the first few chapters in Esquire back in 1975 caused a major scandal. And by the way, he was also like a regular Studio 54, but I know it has nothing to do with this in the 70s. Anyway, columnist Liz Smith explained he wrote what he knew, which is what people always tell writers to do, but he just didn't wait until they were dead to do it. With these first short publications, Capote found that many of his close friends and acquaintances shut him off completely. Though he claimed to be working on answer prayers, the shock of the initial negative reaction sent him into a spiral of drug and alcohol use, during which time he wrote very little of any quality. When he died in 1984 at the age of 59, he left behind no evidence of any continued progress on that book, Answered Prayers. So, now, A Christmas Memory, and the source for this is Wikipedia, was published in 1956 in the magazine Mademoiselle. It was reprinted in the Selected Writings of Truman Capote in 1963. It has been issued as a standalone hardcover edition by Random House starting in 1966, and it has been published in many editions and anthologies ever since. This is a largely autobiographical story, although it is set up as a piece of fiction, but it's, you know, the line is significantly blurred. It is set in the 1930s. It describes a period in the lives of the 7-year-old narrator and an elderly woman who is his distant cousin as well as his best friend. The woman was Nanny Falk, elder sister of the household where Capote's wayward parents deposited him as a young boy. Nanny, who everyone called Sook, was thought to be developmentally disabled, but Capote later wrote a friend, "I had an elderly cousin, the woman in my story, A Christmas Memory, who was a genius." The evocative narrative focuses on country life, friendship, and the joy of giving during the Christmas season, and it also gently yet poignantly touches on loneliness and loss. Now a holiday classic, it has been broadcast, recorded, filmed, staged multiple times in award-winning productions. Most notably, it was adapted for ABC's Stage 67 by Capote and Eleanor Perry. That starred Geraldine Page and Donnie Melvin, and Truman Capote was the narrator. Both the teleplay and the program star, Geraldine Page, won Emmy Awards for it, and it also won a Peabody. It's available on video under such titles as ABC's Playhouse 67, A Christmas Memory, or Truman Capote's A Christmas Memory. And this version was also released in cinemas by Allied Artists in 1969. Now, the story itself is narrated by an unnamed 7-year-old boy who is addressed as Buddy by his older cousin. It's about the narrator's relationship with this older cousin. She's unnamed as well. Neither of the main characters of the story have names. There are a couple supporting characters who have names, but the boy and the girl do not. She is an older female cousin whom he refers to throughout the story as my friend. In later adaptations, she is sometimes called Sook. Buddy and his cousin, who are eccentric and childlike, live in a house with other relatives who are authoritarian and stern and have named a dog named Queenie. The family is very poor. Buddy looks forward to Christmas every year, nevertheless, and he and his elderly cousins save their pennies for this occasion. Every year at Christmas time, Buddy and his friend collect pecans, and buy other ingredients to make fruitcakes. Although set during Prohibition, this includes whiskey, which they buy from a scary but ultimately friendly Native American bootlegger named Ha Ha Jones. They send the cakes to acquaintances they have met only once or twice, and to people they've never met at all, such as President Roosevelt. This year, after the two have finished the elaborate 4-day production of making fruitcakes, the elderly cousin decides to celebrate by finishing off the remaining whiskey. This leads to the two of them becoming giddy drunk and the older cousin being severely reprimanded by angry relatives for letting the younger cousin imbibe. She runs off to her room crying, but Buddy follows and comforts her with thoughts of Christmas rituals. The next day, Buddy and his friend go to a faraway grove, which the elderly cousin has proclaimed the best place by far to chop down a Christmas tree. They manage to chop and carry home a large and beautiful tree despite the arduousness of the task. They spend the following days making decorations for the tree and presents for the relatives, Queenie and each other. Buddy and the older cousin keep their gifts to each other a secret, and although Buddy knows that his friend desperately wishes she could afford to get him a bike, he assumes his friend has made him a kite, as she has every year, and he has made her one, too. Come Christmas morning, the two of them are up at the crack of dawn, anxious to open their presents. Buddy is extremely disappointed, having received the rather dismal gifts of old hand-me-downs and a subscription to a religious magazine. His friend has gotten the somewhat better gifts of oranges and hand-knitted scarves. Queenie gets a bone, as she does every year. Then they exchange their joyful presents to each other, the two kites, and Buddy's friend tells him that the kite he made is her favorite gift that year. In a beautiful hidden meadow, they fly the kites that day in the clear winter sky while eating the older cousin's Christmas oranges. The elderly cousin thinks of this as heaven and says that God and heaven must be like this. It is their last Christmas together. The following year, the boy is sent to military school. Although Buddy and his friend keep up constant correspondence, this is unable to last because his elderly cousin suffers more and more of the ravages of old age and slips into dementia. Soon she is unable to remember who Buddy is, and not long after she passes away. The story ends with this. And when that happens, I know it. A message saying so merely confirms a place of news some secret vein had already received, severing me from an irreplaceable part of myself, letting it loose like a kite on a broken string. That is why, walking across the school campus on this particular December morning, I keep searching the sky, as if I expected to see, rather like hearts, a lost pair of kites hurrying toward heaven. All right. So, what did you think of this one?
Oh, this one's my favorite, so I'm a little disappointed you put it in the middle. And I think that that might point to some biases that you
have. No, I put it in the middle because I ordered them chronologically.
Oh, okay. That's what, that's literally Tom is saying. He's trying to hide his implicit biases. I will also say that I highly recommend the FX series Capote versus the Swans, which is a feud. I think it's the third season of Feud, but they're all separate and self-contained. But
it's a Ryan Murphy.
Amazing acting, like high-profile actors in there. And it was just really interesting to see, as you were talking about, the people that he surrounded himself with. Yes, I really liked this. I thought that this was lovely. And just this really interesting familial as well as friendship, this familial relationship as well as this friendship between, you know, someone at the end of their life and someone just beginning. And just, yeah, how sweet it was and just doing these mundane things, but also I think imbuing all of these mundane things with love and care for other people. I felt like this really got down to what Christmas represents overall. So yeah, the messaging, the messaging was great and it was just so lovely.
It's really poignant too. Especially toward the end. We'll talk about the end a little later, but yeah, I agree with you. I really like this. I did not know what to expect from this. I had never read this before. Out of all three of these, this is the only, this is my first time on this one. And, no, I really enjoyed it. I like the fact that it has a contrasting sort of, in a sense, it has a contrasting feel to the Dylan Thomas piece because there's a little bit of whimsy in it, but it's not as whimsical purposefully. And it has a lot, this has a little bit more depth and heart to it. And for all, also for all the other reasons you said. And one thing I noticed too, is that like, so this it's written as a piece of fiction, but even Capote said, as I said in the bio stuff, it was pretty much an autobiographical short story. So here, when we talk about the reliability of the narrator, I think we need him to be as accurate as he can, or at least pull as accurate as he can for his memories so that we can really understand the story. And I think it has a bit better impact if he creates, even if the narrator is a guy looking back on his childhood and it's the point of view of a 7-year-old. I mean, do you agree with me on that? That like we need a reliable narrator here as opposed to Dylan Thomas, where we actually, he can kind of work the unreliability to his advantage.
I would like to know why.
Because this story is grounded in a big way in a lot of reality. Like, it's a realistically told story. Like, he's going for realism, and he's going for being realistic, as opposed to Thomas, who is being realistic, but he's also being fanciful and exaggerating. He uses quite a bit of hyperbole. Capote is way more grounded in the way I've seen him writing here, and I think that making sure that you are being accurate and reliable as a writer or the narrator, somebody you think is telling you the truth about this story and not spinning the yarn, I think that's really important.
Yeah, I suppose that's true because you're getting so emotionally invested that I think it's more powerful for you to become emotionally invested and find out that it's real rather than emotionally invested. You're like, oh, that was nice, and then put it aside. I think it might stay with you longer, recognizing that it is more of a work of nonfiction. Also thinking about just what Truman Capote kind of his life, what he went through, kind of all the stages. Like, this is lovely compared to other things that he suffered and endured. Mm-hmm. So it's also nice to hold on to that.
Yeah. I think the other thing that helps with the reliability helps with is the characterization, especially of his cousin, because I mean, he doesn't say that she's mentally challenged in any way, but it seems like he's showing that to us. I feel that he is giving a realistic portrayal of her. He is being very respectful toward her and being sympathetic without being making us feel sorry for her. Like, what's your take on the way he portrays his cousin?
Yeah, because I think if you read it just as is, you don't necessarily get that much of a sense of it, because I think it's so focused on her heart and her goodness and how kind, because she's not like doing silly things that would like automatically impress upon us that she might be challenged in some way. Yeah. I mean, maybe that she's sending a fruitcake to Eleanor Roosevelt. maybe that. But otherwise, it's just like, this is lovely. And it's almost as if like she still has that childlike innocence. But I never saw it as some sort of deficit. So I feel like he does a great job. And I saw it more as just her whole being very representative of her heart rather than her having some sort of challenge.
Yeah. She's very innocent. She's much older. She's in her 60 something, according to him.
Yeah.
But she's very innocent, even in the way like he describes some of the things that they would get into and get up to as almost like kids. He sounds like when they create like a freaks museum or something.
Yeah.
Like here's the fantastic thing, freaks, and like the freak was like a three-legged chicken, but then the fantastic part of the world was like somebody's like basically like a stereoscope or cinescope or whatever, like a slideshow of places that their family friend had visited. Like, here's New York and here's Paris, and they got like in trouble for that. They get into a little bit of mischief, but it doesn't seem. It is very wholesome and innocent. Even going to the one illegal thing they do, which is going and getting booze, because it's prohibition, and they go to Haha Jones, who's this. And now, I use the word Native American. I will say that if you did read this or you're planning on reading this, you will see him use the word Indian, because this was written back in the 1950s and Indian was the accepted and mostly used word for indigenous people. What did you think of the portrayal of this guy? Because like for them, they're like, we never see him. We always see his wife. And all of a sudden he shows up and they're like, he's really intimidating. And then he's actually kind of funny. And it's like, they're like, what do you need it for? And they're like, we're making a fruitcake. He's like, you're kind of wasting good whiskey on a fruitcake, but like, you know, make sure you bring one of these back and I won't charge you for it. I mean, like, what did you think of the portrayal of the Native American, American Indian? Haha.
I feel like it's very much a outward appearances do not necessarily dictate a person's character. And I don't know how woke, you know, Capote actually was. I mean, he was a gay man, so he had his own struggles to deal with in that particular time. But, you know, how he's describing this person, it's like, oh, okay. We're like a step away from calling him a savage, you know, like the quintessential, you know, Pocahontas term, the Disney movie.
No, I know.
Then he pops out and he you know, he's every bit as they had described him physically, but his cousin is counting out the change, and that, and she gives him the money and then he gives it back to them. And I thought in that one transaction, you saw like what type of person HaHa actually is. So I thought that that was a great moment as well.
It's really subtle too. Because it's a simple moment and you're getting this whole point about, you know, appearances are deceiving, and not only appearances, but like your conception of somebody before you even meet them, right? That sometimes you have an idea about who this person is built up in your head before you meet them. And sometimes it's, you know, often proven wrong, and sometimes it's proven wrong in a bad way. And this is proven wrong in a very positive way. But he doesn't linger on the point. Like, he just shows it to us and lets us think about it. And I think that's really, really well done. Cause he doesn't hit us over the head with it. And yeah, and I thought that moment was pretty clever, pretty funny too. And it's, what's interesting too, is this is set in the Depression, and they're living. I mean, it was the Depression in rural America. They're poor. Right. How did you see that poverty showing itself and then affecting the story, either in a positive or a negative way?
Oh, affecting the story.
Or affecting like them or as characters, not as like making the story good or bad.
Yeah. Well, obviously they have to be very cautious in how they're spending that money. And I think so. It's all around them that they're obviously not in a well-to-do or maybe even a comfortable financially situation. But again, I think it shows the care that these two characters / real life people have for other people, because all of the money really goes for somebody else, whether it was the fruitcakes or making gifts for each other, which happens to be the same gift, a kite.
Yeah.
And then, you know, getting the dog a bone, et cetera. So it was very much about not, what don't we have, and, what would we want if we had something? It's all about, this is what we have. What can we do with it in order to make somebody's life a little bit better?
Yeah, I agree with you. And what I like is the story is not about them being poor and growing up in abject poverty or word of the poverty of the Depression. It just happens to be a fact of life. And he does explain like how they get their money, or that money is scarce because it's just the reality of the situation. But like I said, it's not the central idea. The central idea is the friendship between these two. I would imagine that his audience in 1956, if it was an audience of people around our age, they would have lived through the Depression to some degree. So he doesn't need to be over-explanatory in it, but he also probably feels that he needs to be accurate. And I think he does a really good job of getting it across without, you know, again, having to really explain what all this is. This is a recommendation if anybody wants to read a really great account of the Great Depression. Studs Terkel, the journalist and historian, wrote a book called Hard Times, which is an oral history of the Depression. It's just interview after interview of people who had lived through in all walks of life and survived the Depression. It's a really dense book, but it's a really, really good like primary source artifact. Anyway, back to this. So we have this friendship between the two of them. And technically, she's also supposed to be kind of his babysitter. Is not like the best word for it, but like she's the older person watching out after the little kid to a certain extent. But like, do you get the sense that like they're actually taking care of each other in some way, and that it's not like it's totally imbalanced where she's taking care of him? I mean, like, who's taking care of whom?
Yeah, I think it's a mutual. I think they're living together, they're surviving together. Yeah, he was kind of pawned off. He doesn't have a good relationship with his mother, and she kind of offloaded him on relatives. And that could create some resentful feelings on either side. But here it's just that you don't see that at all. So I think it's a mutual care.
Yeah, and I think it comes out with him caring for her in the part where she gets him drunk. And she gets scolded by the other relatives in the house. The whole thing is kind of really tense. So I'll read the scene. So basically, they get drunk. They're singing drinking songs. They're giggling. Enter two relatives, very angry, potent with eyes that scold, tongues that scald. Listen to what they have to say, the words tumbling together into a wrathful tune. A child of seven, whiskey on his breath. Are you out of your mind? Feeding a child of seven. Must be loony. Road to ruination. Remember Cousin Kate, Uncle Charlie, Uncle Charlie's brother-in-law? Shame, scandal, humiliation. Kneel, pray, beg the Lord. Queenie sneaks under the stove. My friend gazes at her shoes. Her chin quivers. She lifts her skirt and blows her nose and runs to her room. Long after the town has gone to sleep and the house is silent, except for the chiming of the clocks and the sputter of fading fires, she is weeping into a pillow, already as wet as a window's handkerchief. Don't cry, I say, sitting at the bottom of her bed and shivering despite my flannel nightgown that smells of last winter's cough syrup. Don't cry, I beg, teasing her toes, tickling her feet. You're too old for that. And then I'm not going to read the whole thing, but actually, no, it's because she hiccups, I am too old, old and funny. Not funny, fun. More fun than anybody. Listen, if you don't stop crying, you'll be so tired tomorrow we can't go cut a tree. That moment, like, it kind of broke my heart in places because I felt really bad for this woman because she did something wrong, right? But she was scolded in a way that, like, you can see this reaction and, like, her crying in the pillow and everything, and this little kid walking up being like, don't cry. It's a really sad moment that I think shows you how much they care for one another. And why at the end he has this beautiful ending with the kites in the sky and stuff like that. I mean, it's so simply written and yet so beautifully written. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Do you agree with me? I don't know. Like, I kind of trailed off there. I apologize. I mean, like, what do That's you think about right. that moment? I mean,
I don't think I have anything to add to what you said okay. to her.
So at the end, we find out that she's gone. And it was that was our last Christmas together, and then brings us into the present. And I read that earlier. What note is he ending on? Like, how does he want us to feel at the end of the story? Like, why bring us into the present with all of that? Why not just end with the kites flying where they were flying their Christmas presents together and it was a happy moment? Why have a conclusion where you talk about how she deteriorated? She kept confusing him with another guy she knew named Buddy back in the 1880s and eventually passed away. Mm-hmm. And you have this ending that I read.
Yeah, I suppose to make sure people hold on to all their precious memories, I think, because I think at the time of writing, obviously, Truman can look back. But at the moment that he left at the moment that they were doing all the things they were doing for Christmas, he didn't know that that was going to be the last Christmas that they would spend together. And perhaps he would have maybe not necessarily done anything differently, but perhaps contemplated things a bit more and cherished things a bit more. And so that's why I feel like he's leaving us in this way, because looking back, he realized, oh, that was the last one, and look at how special it was.
Yeah, and I think he purposely ends on a bittersweet sort of mood, right? That and the nostalgia here is very genuine in the same way that Thomas's is, but Thomas makes us feel warm and fuzzy. And there's a sadness, a melancholy to this, but it's not tragic. There's a little tragic about the way her eventual fate, but this is still a nice memory. Yeah, I really, like you said, I really enjoyed this as well. Okay, anything else about this before we move on?
No.
Okay. Next up is Duel in the Snow, or Red Rider Nails the Cleveland Street Kid. It is by Gene Shepherd. This is his bio. I will say that I actually took this from the Internet Movie Database. So this is from IMDb. Raised in Hammond, Indiana, Gene Shepherd went on to work in the steel mills and was a veteran of the Army Signal Corps before entering the arts. In the 1950s, he began a long career as a radio personality, telling stories of his youth, commenting on current topics, and performing silly songs. While at WORAM in New York, he also broadcast live nightclub acts from the limelight in Greenwich Village. He wrote for Playboy and other magazines. His articles were published in a series of books, including The America of George Ade, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters, A Fistful of Fig Newtons, and The Ferrari in the Bedroom. During the 1970s, he did two series of humorous programs as well as several American Playhouse episodes for PBS. In 1983, he wrote his first feature film, A Christmas Story, putting together many tales of his semi-autobiographical character, Ralphie. The sequel, My Summer Story, was made in 1994. Now, this particular essay or story is taken from the book In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. And so I'm going to give you guys a little bit of background on that book. Gene Shepherd mainly performed on the radio, like I said, in the decades after World War II. And I think when I think of him and I read this, I also think of another author, a little bit of a different tone to this author, but I think of Garrison Keillor, who used to do the Lake Wobegon stories on NPR. I remember having to listen to those in a couple of creative writing classes back in the day. Anyway, beginning in June 1964, he began adapting many of his radio stories for publication in Playboy. He focused primarily on those stories that depicted his childhood in the fiction town of Homan, Indiana, which was a stand-in for his hometown of Hammond. According to Hugh Hefner, of all people, author Shel Silverstein, one of my favorite poets, had long encouraged Shepherd to write down his radio stories, but Shepherd was reluctant to do so because he said he was not a writer. Eventually, Silverstein recorded Shepherd's stories on tape, transcribed them, and then together with Shepherd, edited and developed the most popular. Shepherd claimed it took him 3 years to complete In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. Some of its stories were the first of Shepherd's work to appear in Playboy. Shepherd's stories are a mix of fact and fiction. Although they are described as nostalgic or memoirs, he described them simply as fictional stories about childhood, so kind of along the lines of like the Capote thing. However, drawn as they were from this radio storytelling, Shepherd wove elements of real life into his tales and certainly took artistic license in exaggerating any real life events that may have served as seeds for his yarns. Eugene Bergman, who published a study of Shepherd's published works, has called the novel his most important work. Anthology editor Gardner Dozios noted in 2002 that it is also Shepherd's best-known work. Decades after his publication, the novel was claimed to have been a New York Times bestseller in 1966, and at the time of his death in 1999, it had been through 10 printings. Of course, the book is notable for containing much of the source material for A Christmas Story, the 1983 film directed by Bob Clark, who notably also directed Porky's. You can actually purchase a book, and I don't know if it's still in print, but years ago at Barnes & Noble, I saw a book called A Christmas Story, and that book contained all the essays or stories that specifically are used for the film, because there's a couple of stories from one of his other books that is used in the film as well. So if that might appear in stores around the Christmas time, if you can pick that up, you get all of what's in A Christmas Story in its original source material. The summary of this essay is not as long as, or the summary of the story is not as long as A Christmas Memory. It's kind of along the lines of my summary of A Christmas, Charles Christmas in Wales, because if you've seen A Christmas Story, and if you haven't, just turn on like TBS or something. It was TBS or TNT on Christmas Eve. If you've seen A Christmas Story, you know the plot of the story. This is the BB gun story. In this story, Gene Shepherd recollects a Christmas he had as a child growing up during the Great Depression in Indiana, where all he wanted for Christmas was a BB gun, specifically an official Red Ryder carbine action 200 shot range model air rifle. And the response to that request several times over, you'll shoot your eye out. He hears this from his mother, from his teacher. He writes, has to write a theme about it. And she writes, you'll shoot your eye out on the paper when she gives it back. And he also hears it from a terrifying department store Santa. All the while, we get the written version of what are a number of very famous moments from the movie A Christmas Story, some of which are taken actually verbatim from this essay. In the movie A Christmas Story, if you haven't seen it, there is a voiceover that is performed by Shepherd himself. And a lot of the description that he gives is literally just word for word from this story. Shepherd also appears in A Christmas Story in Line for Santa, where he tells Ralphie, hey, kid, the line ends here, but it starts all the way back there. Some of the ones that appear that are pretty well known from the movie are like the idea that bundling up for school was like preparing for deep sea diving, hiding the Red Ryder ad in his mom's magazine so she'll see it, the way they shop for a Christmas tree, the actual lines there, the bunny suit that Aunt Clara sends him for Christmas, as well as some of the specific gifts that are open on Christmas Day. The climax of the story comes when, after opening all of his presents, and he doesn't get the BB gun, Shepherd's dad points out another present that's kind of hiding back in the background, and it is the BB gun that he asked for. I almost said Ralphie. Shepherd goes out to the yard to shoot at things, and he grazes his eye with a ricocheted BB and crushes his glasses by accidentally stepping on them. However, his mom doesn't see this, and he's able to fake a story about an icicle hitting him, and he fakes his way out of trouble. And that is this particular story. Duel in the Snow, or Red Ryder Nails the Cleveland Street Kid. What did you think of this one, Stella?
Yeah, so I didn't realize what it was until I read the name Flick, and I was like, oh, is this what it is? As probably one of the very few Americans will say this, I'm a bit saturated on A Christmas Story. Yeah, and I need some space from it.
I watch it once a year. That's it.
Yeah, that's too much for me now. It's like it should be maybe 5 years and then I'll watch it again. But my family really likes it quite, so I kind of have to endure. Yeah, so I think that it is good and funny, and as you would expect, since The Christmas Story is based off of it.
Because I was reading it. When I read it, I could hear his narration from A Christmas Story. Because, like I said, some of the stuff in this story is word for word in the script. He wrote the script for A Christmas Story. So, yeah. I like it as well. I knew what to expect. It was pretty funny. I saw A Christmas Story in the theater when I was a little kid. So I've always loved this movie. It's one of the ones that we watch. I watched on Christmas Eve every year, just once. Alongside, you know, Charlie Brown and Garfield, and when we can stomach Rudolph and Die Hard and Rick Steve Christmas.
National Lampoon.
I have National Lampoon on DVD. I sometimes will just watch certain scenes because I find sometimes that movie drags in places.
Oh, are you saturated?
I think a little bit. I think that's my one that I will only come back to every once in a while. Because I did see that in the theater as well. And I do find that movie like really, really funny. But yeah, that was the one I don't watch that one every year. So you have A Christmas Story and I have National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
There you go. Okay. Yes.
But what's interesting is this. So, like, all three of these stories are told in flashback from an adult, right? This one has a framing device. Instead of opening with him as a kid wanting the BB gun, etc., it opens with this encounter by Shepherd and a woman at an automat. Now, if you're unfamiliar with what an automat was, it was this restaurant where you would just walk in and there would just be these kind of rows of like little doors. And you put a coin or money into a slot or whatever and open the door. And then like there was like your pot pie or your piece of cake.
So that's what
he is. He's eating in an automat. And he runs into this woman who's got like all these buttons and like slogans and stuff. It says like disarm the toy industry. And she is talking about how like toys are too violent these days and she's leading a crusade against them. Why do that? Begin the story this way.
Anti-Vietnam.
No, I know. But like, is that what you think? I mean, like, why begin the story this way? Why not just start in the midst?
Because I think you have, in this case, have to have some sort of catalyst or inciting incident for this flashback. And it was, in fact, this button, and then which relates to violence, and then the whole don't shoot your eye out, and then it happened. So I feel like it was almost one of those, maybe like a set memory, but not like that's the analogy, that this sort of woke up this memory in him. As if, you know, you or I walking somewhere were hit with a smell. Like when I smell, there's a very particular smell that when I smell it, it's like this is the laser cutter in the Ace
Cube. Oh, yeah.
So things like that, I'm just like, oh, my gosh, very particular. So I feel like for him that was almost – it was like a visual cue that, oh, I remember that time I really wanted a Red Ryder BB gun.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And the transition between the present and the past is really, really smooth. Cause Disarm the Toy Industry, like he's looking at the button and he's like, I began to mull over my own youth and of course in its increasing quest for Roscoe's six shooters and any sort of blue hardware, et cetera, et cetera. He's right in there. Like, you know, outside in the spanking December breeze, the Salvation Army Santa Claus listlessly tolled this bell, huddled in a doorway to avoid the direct blast. I sipped my coffee and remembered another Christmas, another time, in another place, and a gun. I remember clearly, itchily, nervously, maddeningly, the first time I laid eyes on it. And then we're into the story with the gun. And I really like the way he transitions there from the framing device in there, and he's giving us a little bit of humor too with the woman, because he's kind of looking at her like, you are a crazy hippie. Like, mm-hmm. And then at the end he comes out of it at the end right after he gets away with lying to his mother and is able to just talk about how he just kind of threw his coffee away and walked on, and that was the memory and stuff. And I think that's a really good, I think it's a really, really well transitioned thing. Now, it's not necessary for the film, but it really does, it does work. You know, what's interesting to me too is he kind of goes on to what he used to play and stuff like that. I always find it interesting the amount of like adventure and action things that were marketed or still are in some level to boys in, and the very gendered nature of toys back in, you know, back mm-hmm. in the day. Should we look into how this is kind of showing or upholding those gender roles of toys or something, or is that just kind of like one of those weird analytical red herrings that people tend to fall down because they just want to, you know, make it something that it's not?
Yeah, I think it's just a sign of the times. I mean, I wasn't very distracted by that, which makes the whole bunny rabbit thing pretty endearing because that obviously is like a misgendering sort of situation. And it even says like my aunt or whatever who is under the delusion or something like that. That
I was like I'm a six-year-old girl or something.
Yeah. Yes. So I don't think so. I mean, we can get as upset as we're want to do. And I think typically we do bring up sort of, gender inequality and assumptions and things like that. But I think this is, just a sign of the times.
Yeah. And I think that, it's about a BB gun, but it's not like weirdly aggressive in any way or shows, you know, it's kids playing pretend, right? And the way mm-hmm. boys would play, and there's nothing really particularly offensive or toxic about the masculinity to be described here. So it's a fun, fond memory of a boy in his childhood. And that's kind of where I take it. And I really don't read into anything beyond that and the Americana aspect of it. So, but I just thought it was, I always find it interesting when I read through, a story like this, or you know, I read a lot. You probably you hear enough or read enough as well. We both read a fair amount of old comics, right? And if you go back into the Silver Age and into the 50s and into the 40s and stuff, you see a lot of advertisements. You see the very gendered advertisements where you had comics, like romance comics were full of the stuff that girls might be more interested in for some reason, like dieting, in terms of some of the ads. But the boys had like the Charles Atlas ad, or they had the ad for the BB gun, or things like that. And stories for boys were always presented in the realm of your Treasure Island, Swiss Family Robinson, the adventure thing. So I just thought, that crossed my mind as I was reading this, because it's like, oh, it's like boys were always told adventure stories and such. So it's just kind of more of this kind of like an interesting thing to me than it was like, we're going to look into this and talk about the patriarchy.
Yeah. Well, it'd be different if he had a brother. Like, I wonder what that would have looked like.
Well, he does.
If he had a sister.
Yeah.
It is different because like we can't see any difference. So he has a brother. If he had a sister, I wonder what that would look like.
Randy in the movie is, you know, whiny and stuff and funny. Ooh, a Zeppelin. Oh, that's mine. Brett's favorite line of the movie is after when they're assaulted by Scott Farkas, and Randy's like laying in the snow, and the line is, Randy lay there like a slug. It was his only defense. So that's Brett's favorite line of the entire movie. So much like Dylan Thomas, Shepard uses a lot of hyperbole, especially when describing snow. How does that contribute to the story, and does it work as well as Dylan Thomas's?
About
just in
snow?
General hyperbole and exaggeration.
Oh, yeah. Hyperbole. Yeah, I would say that this works really well because this kid is really dramatic. and I think at every turn you can get that sense from him. So, his hyperbole I think works and makes everything bigger and more at stake than it actually is.
Yeah. It's also, I think, contributes to the humor. It does in Thomas's as well, but this really, the exaggeration and the description of exaggeration, exaggerated descriptions really do contribute to some of the really funnier moments and aspects of humor in the book as in the story as well. What's interesting too is like this is the Depression as well, and much like Capote, the poverty and the downtroddenness of the Depression is not the point of the story. It's mentioned, what's interesting is mentioned on page 27 of at least the book, not of the PDF. He's giving us kind of the lay of the land of his neighborhood. And he's talking about like, you know, how they're all walking to school, all painfully toiling toward Warren G. Harding School, miles away over the tundra, waddling under the weight of frost-covered clothing like tiny frozen bowling balls with feet. But then he would talk about off on the far horizon, beyond the railroad yards and the great refinery tanks, lay our own private mountain range, dark and mysterious, cold and uninhabited, outlined against the steel gray skies of Indiana winter, the mills. It was the Depression, and the natives had been idle so long that they no longer even considered themselves out of work. Work had ceased to exist, so how could you be out of it? A few here and there picked up a day or so a month at the roundhouse or the freight yards or the slag heaps at the mill. But mostly they just spent their time clipping out coupons from the back pages of True Romances magazine, coupons that promise virgin territories for distributing ready-made suits door-to-door and offering untold riches, repairing radios through correspondence courses. And then next is just the description of looking in the department store window when they go to the store. It's this like odd paragraph that like you don't necessarily need. So why include this description of Indiana during the Depression?
Quite frankly, I don't know, because I feel like it contrasts or contradicts the remaining bits of the short story, because he somehow has an allowance.
Yeah, because his dad's employed.
Yeah. because he breaks a window and gets to pay for his allowance. Yeah. So that's how I've. And then these gifts, it seems like they get enough of gifts there. So you're saying they're the haves of Indiana versus the have nots of what we just had.
Yeah. So I get.
Well, I don't know if I will say then that Ralphie, whoever this man is, is very different than Buddy in our previous one because he's really wanting a lot compared to a lot of people in that state who would have an inability of getting anything for Christmas.
Yeah. Now, I mean, he's not rich. He's firmly middle class, you get the impression his father is of the working class. He is just apparently just was fortunate enough to not lose his job and therefore was able to bring home money to support his family. The only reason I can see him putting this in here, and I will tell you, it's a really, really good description. Like, it's very well written, this commentary of it and the frustration of, like, you know, what are you going to do at this point, right? Everybody's kind of out of work and, man, they just do their best to get by. And you're just like, you know, the only thing I could think of him putting in there is as a way of checking his privilege in the story, that, like, he's acknowledging on some level that there were people who were much worse off than he was. And he did see them. He didn't ignore them or anything like that, even though he was like seven or he remembers them and stuff. So he's giving a more realistic perspective for us. I don't think it totally works. I think if you could excise that paragraph and go from lovely, beautiful, glorious Christmas around which the whole year revolved to downtown home and was prepared for its yearly bacchanalia of peace on earth and goodwill to men and go to the department store without the paragraph. So it doesn't, it is kind of out of place, but I think I get why he's getting at it. I just don't, I think it doesn't necessarily work that much for me.
No, I think it portrays him in a negative light, to be honest.
So moving on from there, do you think he gets the behavior and dialogue of the kids right? Or is he just kind of creating kid characters and we've come to accept these as this is how kids talked?
Well, I feel like kids in another age, not in this current age, seemed more intelligent and maybe were a bit more advanced. So I buy it.
Yeah. I thought we talk about a reliability. I think he is going for that authenticity. But what about his father? So his father is interesting. And Darren McGavin plays the father in the movie. And again, this is very much what we see in the movie with him fighting the furnace and like cursing up a storm while doing it. And he's a gruff old man and stuff like that. Like, how do you think he views his father, or how are we supposed to view him as an audience?
I don't necessarily see an emotional connection between either of his parents and, pseudonym Ralphie. He just seems like a stern man and I think that might be like a generalization anyways of fathers that, you know, they're kind of the grumpy people of the partnership. And you don't want to cross them and they're the ones that might mete out the penalties. And so of course he's going to go to his mom after the incident. Cause she might be more sympathetic. Mm-hmm. But other than that, yeah, you don't really get too much of an emotional sense. And I'm trying not to blend the movie with this right here because I think there's always a certain level of hero worship from a son to a father. And that's really a sense that I got, especially with that lug nut scene with the changing of the tire business. But I didn't get a sense of that in this excerpt.
Yeah, in the I'm trying to find the part where he actually gets the gun. It is his father who points out the gun or the gift. Like it, just like in the film, he's the one who says, "I think I see a gift over there." And what the way this is he describes the packing. He opens it up. Over the radio thundered a thousand voice heavenly choir. Joy to the world, the Lord has come, which is pretty funny. My mother sat and smiled a weak, doubtful smile when my old man grinned broadly from behind his wine glass, and then he goes into the actual gun. In the movie, it's a little more affectionate, because if you watch Darren McGavin in the scene where Ralphie has the gun, he's like, oh, they go all over, and he's shown shaking the thing and everything, and Melinda Dillon looks at him like this connection that she didn't realize, and like why he bought the gun for him is because it is a connection he's making with his son, because the entire movie, he is basically as gruff as he is in the story. So I think here it doesn't really land the way it does in the film. And he is just kind of like, he's more proud that he bought the kid the gun than he is just sort of like indulging in this nostalgia because he had one when he was a boy, which is a totally different thing. Right. And you're right that the relationship between the parents in the story here, not between the kid and the parent, Ralphie, so Gene Shepherd and his parents, seems more like they are essentially adversaries and in his way to getting this BB gun. Am I wrong there? Like, he's just scheming against them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The father's use of profanity is pretty funny, though. Okay, so I'm going to tell you what one of my favorite passages is, because I find the story very funny. We were talking about the humor a little bit early, but I do need to – we will move on to the overall general questions. So we're in the department store. We're climbed up to see Santa, you know, ho, 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 right? And it's just this – these two sentences cracked me up, and I literally highlighted them. Santa's warm, moist breath poured down over me as though from some cosmic steam radiator. Santa smoked camels like my Uncle Charles. I have no question there. I just wanted to read that sentence because it cracked me up reading it.
That he knew about the camels.
Santa smoked camels. Now, going back to the automat thing at the end, when we get back to him, and then we're going to get to our like six or so questions about all three of the stories. He goes to his mother, faking the crying, etc. And then he said, actually, I started to actually sob because the real thing took over. I was down in the bathroom. My mom patched me up. I had pulled it off. And then I sipped the bitter dregs of coffee that remained in my cup, suddenly catapulted by a falling tray back into the cheerful, impersonal, brightly lit clatter of Horn and Hardit, which is the automat. I wondered whether Red Ryder was still dispensing retribution and frontier justice as of old. Considering the number of kids I see with broken glasses, I suspect he is. And that's how the essay, the story ends. Did the transition out of the story into the need to be longer? Is this too abrupt of an ending? Did you need more?
Yeah, I probably would have liked to have more of a resolution to Christmas and what happened with the BB gun and getting new glasses, etc. I mean, it's a nice little fade to black to the initial scene in a ring composition. But I would have liked some more.
I agree. I think it just needed a either something in the past or something in the present. It just needed a little bit more. But at the same time, the idea that he is shaken out of this memory in the story because somebody dropped a tray behind him and it just kind of jarred him back into the moment is realistic. You know, it happens. So it's just kind of like it is kind of a good way, clever way to end it. And I do like the sentence at the end about the crushed glasses, you know, like I suspect he's still doing this, but yeah, I think it's just missing something at the end. It's almost like he had to end this. So he just kind of whipped this up. And that's how I felt. Now we're talking about all three of these stories at the moment. I've got a few questions. When we talk about the tone of all three of these, how does that affect the way that we like look at them and we read them? Like, you know, when you think about the tone of each of them, how does it affect the way you're like, you know, how effective is it and how well used is it?
I guess it goes back to that emotional connection point that I had made earlier in regards to the realism and whether it's nonfiction or not, because I think I'm going to have more of an emotional connection with something that has more of a serious tone, depending on upon what the message is that each of these are meant to relay. But yeah, I mean, I think the third one is light intentionally. But the middle one, while it might be lighter, it's also, I think there's much gravitas to it as well. And so I just, it resonates with me a bit more. Yeah, I guess, does that answer
your question? Yeah, and I'll add this, something I always talk to my students about is that tone affects mood. So when the writer is putting something into their voice to create very often to help create the mood that you're getting out of it, and the reaction that you have, the emotion that you have comes from partially that tone. And I think what you were saying is exactly right. And I'll add that they all know exactly the tone to use to get the feeling that we get out of the story. And I think they all do it skillfully. Now, these are all significantly old. Thomas's story was written in the 40s and recorded in they're all from like the 50s and 60s, essentially. Thomas is the oldest one, having been recorded in 52, but like published in like 1950, and has kind of earlier origins. Capote's story was published in 56, I believe it was. And then this, I think, was originally published in the 60s at some point. I don't remember exactly when it was published in Playboy, or if it was. How do the authors make this timeless, despite the fact that they are very specific to the time periods that they take place in?
I think wisely choosing Christmas as the setting beyond the year. I think having a Christmas, because I just think about The Night Before Christmas, which is a rather old story. And that is just, you know, people still, I think I should actually check my facts with like my freshmen and wonder if they know it, The Night Before Christmas, or not The Night Before Christmas. Yeah, yeah, it was The Night Before Christmas.
St. Nicholas, yeah.
Oh, I was on Dasher, on Dancer, conflating it with The Nightmare Before Christmas. Yeah, so I think just Christmas itself is timeless, and anyone, you know, no matter creed, gender, age, can get behind, well, I shouldn't say this, but get behind some sort of holiday, if I were to generalize, maybe Christmas. So I think that's why it's pretty timeless.
I agree with you. And I think they all feature things that most audiences can relate to on some level. I think we might not have the exact experiences of a Dylan Thomas, but some of the things he talks about, like, I can totally picture in some variation. Getting up to things with your friend, like the way Capote does, Capote is probably the one I have the most disconnection with, but at the same time, the poignance there and everything like that, I feel it feels relatable. And then we all wanted that thing for Christmas in some way or shape or form. It might not have been a BB gun, but like, again, there's a connection there. What's interesting to me, I'm going to flip the questions that I have. They're all flashbacks told from the point of view of the adult, as opposed to just writing it as the kid. Would the stories work if it was just if it was total kid narration, and not an adult looking back with a certain amount of self-awareness?
I think the language wouldn't be believable, because you're going to have to change it. Well, I did say that I think children of a different era were a bit more advanced. I think that still they wouldn't necessarily be speaking this way, or have maybe this amount of knowledge is not what I'm looking for, but kind of like this sense that these are important things that I need to note, and it would be less believable.
Yeah, it wouldn't have as much depth.
It would probably be like Catcher in the Rye. You'd think that it was very pretentious.
Yeah, because all three of these kids are around the same age. I think Ralphie's supposed to be about 9 or 10, and Capote's story narrator is 7, and Thomas is supposed to be sometime around the same age, right? A little kid, probably like 10 or 11. The voice would not be authentic. It would come off as pretentious, or it would be just not believable. But be giving it an adult voice with to add commentary and give the narrator some self-awareness also really helps. But what's interesting to me, or what's just as interesting, because we've covered other Christmas stories, and there's two things that stuck out to me. There's very little mention of religion in this. I think there might have been religion.
What?
Christianity. Oh, right. Like there really isn't. There might have been a mention of church or something, or I know that at one point they talk about singing Hark the Herald Angels Sing in the Dylan Thomas piece, but it's very secular. Is this notable? I mean, like, what is it sacrilegious? I mean, just should it matter that there's no Christian allegory in here or anything like that to send that sort of message?
I just want the people to note Tom's particular use of language and how he just asked that question, because he said that we have done several like Christmas novels, and I feel like 9 out of 10 of the Christmas novels he's chosen. So that was really political. And in this time, of political upheaval, we just need to be careful listening to certain people. So
yes, I'm an unreliable narrator.
Yeah, I don't trust him. And this has been going on for several years, but I don't trust this guy. I do not think that it's sacrilegious. I think it's another way to bring everyone together and to have a unifying factor, because I think that maybe if you do put religion over it, it's going to push some people off. And also, I think given your background, you might be able to see some religion in it anyways, like very much, you know, the cousin I felt is very Christ-like in her love for other people and her selflessness. So I think there are threads and themes, and I don't think that we necessarily need to be hit over the head with it. I mean, with Ralphie, pseudonym's story, I mean, that's so like consumerism and you kind of worry about that. But again, it goes back to your question about tone. So we're not supposed to take it super seriously.
And there's also a total innocence in Ralphie's, or the Gene Shepherd story, like, you know, because that's what kids are like, right? And want. But no, I agree with you. And because it doesn't need to be a morality tale and be that very specific to get the point across about what Christmas is to a number of people, and the feeling of, in some way, togetherness, the childlike wonder of it and things like that. And so it's, because it's interesting too, because you just kind of slide into one of the last questions. The books that we've done now, I have three. We've had a couple of tragedies, right? We had A Doll's House, which is, you know, on some level tragic at the end, right? She leaves him on Christmas night. You picked Ethan Frome, which,
oh, wow, he got so close,
which
to
is me. Which is also, you know, tragic in its ending. And then we have the redemption arc, which is A Christmas Carol. And there are other famous stories involve some sort of realization, redemption about life having meaning. Like It's a Wonderful Life, for instance, which is one of the most famous Christmas movies of all time. Like this is almost like I don't even know if I have a question here. I just wanted to make the point that these are almost like in their own class of type of Christmas story, where they're not morality plays in some way or form, right? There's no lesson to be learned about avarice and being a miser, or seeing that the people around you care for you and love you and would want you to be there, you know, when you wish you'd never been born, or, you know, don't be emotionally abusive to your wife, or don't cheat on your wife because, and then get on a sleigh. You know, like, it's interesting how those all have this moral aspect to them. These have morality to them, but they're not like fables. They're not like morality tells that are there to teach a lesson. You can glean lessons from these. You can glean things from them, but they're not, like you said, they're not hitting us over the head with them. And I found that interesting. How would you work these stories, any of these stories, if you were writing them now? Like, if they were taking place now, what do you think we'd see a little bit of? Putting aside cell phones, because that's always the one that has cell phones. But, like, what would you think would be different and similar about these?
COVID would be interesting. Because I remember not being able to spend Thanksgiving with my family during COVID. So, and I'm trying to think of what Christmas was like. So that would be interesting. As well as maybe like the, now the question is how much in the real world did these get into? I mean, I guess the depression was like the main thing. Cause I'm just thinking, like, would they represent kind of the socio-political aspects of what's going on, currently? With like lots of fear, et cetera. It'd be interesting, and, you know, taking a page from your book, like, what would a short story look like for, like, the first Christmas post 9/11, where families are probably missing family members, things like that. So I would hope that they would be more poignant, but I feel like consumerism and capitalism has only gone up. So, it would be balancing that, like, materialism with, good messaging, but it'd be hard.
Because the politics might come in through the narration, but the kids might not be completely aware of them, depending on what age of the kid you had, right? Because not every kid is aware of the politics of the world and what their parents believe and stuff like that. Now, some parents do just smack them over the head with the politics of the day, even though they're 6 or 7 years old. Others just kind of let them be innocent. So, you know, that could go either way. I would say the BB gun story, probably you don't have to do much to it to set it today's society. You just might change the gift. But, you know, a little kid pestering his parents for a particular gift and then having all these little anecdotal things about, you know, Santa at the mall and buying a Christmas tree and bundling up and all these things, little commentaries, I think would probably... You can almost swap them out one for one for a different time period. The Capote story, I think, could work if it was like a suburban neighborhood or something, but it would be interesting to see how you would adapt that or retell that in the modern day, because it seems the most specific to its time out of the three. The Dylan Thomas piece, I think you just need to swap out whatever. If you have memories of Christmas that all blend together, you just need to swap that out for this. I think that's what the timelessness of that piece is. All right. So which, if any of these, are required reading?
I would say A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote.
I agree. If you are a big fan of A Christmas Story, I would recommend reading Shepherd's Books. But that's like really specific to, I'm a fan of this. If you want to read more, I would pick up In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, because it's a great book. I don't think that's required reading, especially if you know the movie, like you're there's not much else to give. The Dylan Thomas story, if somebody asked me if it was any good, I'd say, yeah, go ahead and read it or listen to it. Really. It's a fun 20 minutes, and it's soothing and everything, but yeah, the one I would recommend the most, or the one I would require, is A Christmas Memory. Because I think it has a lot more layers to it too. So, all right. So we have an email. We might have had some Facebook comments, but I was not able to get the time to go through them. So I will go look for them for next episode. But I'll go ahead and read it, and then we can wrap up. It is from John Schaefer Hames, and it is about Dracula. Dear Tom and Stella, I really enjoyed your episode on Dracula. Your takes on the feminist aspects of the book were especially interesting, as we're listening to how your and my opinions matched and diverged. Dracula is my favorite work of classical literature. There are many valid criticisms of the work, most of which you touched upon, some of which were even mentioned in contemporary reviews of the novel. Lucy's Before I Die, I Have to Jot Down Everything in Detail in Order letter was so commonly lampooned that Lovecraft based his entire shtick on it years later. I think, but I do not think it is underrated by many, in part because some of its better aspects aren't as clear to modern readers. And to demonstrate how thrilled I would have been had Tom's bit about establishment of identity had continued for several hours, please indulge me as I nerd out about this book. This is going to be a while. Some of this is from memory of various introductions and annotated versions, which I don't have handy, so many errors are mine. Any errors are mine. So first, the format. You can't talk about this book outside of the format of the novel. The epistolary novel was very popular at the time of Dracula's publication. It was by no means the first novel to use the format, but probably was the first one to use it as a prop within its own universe. The book that we're reading is the collection of papers mentioned in the introductory note, put together by Mina as part of the plot of the novel, and is mentioned as being completed in the last chapter. With that in mind, things such as the chosen order presentation of the documents become more interesting, as they are not in chronological order. The novel is a research paper. It was, in a way, the true crime podcast of its day. It's meant to be the definitive account of a group of investigators solving a mystery. As you pointed out in the episode, the tropes of Dracula are hardwired into our collective psyche, so it's easy to forget that neither the characters nor the readers find out where Dracula is until halfway through the book. Number two, modernity versus tradition / superstition. This might be the conflict theory sociology student from long ago influencing me, but it's fun to look at this book as representing the struggle between these aspects as the Victorian age was about to end in a year or so, and the Industrial Revolution would have felt like it does now to folks in terms of rapidly changing technology and new social and moral ideas. This is represented both by the good guys versus Dracula, as well as Mina and Lucy representing tradition versus modernity in regards to relationships between genders. What's cool is that rather than one or the other being shown to be outright superior to the other, there is a struggle. Dracula has the upper hand in the first half, but still finds himself stymied by aspects of modernity that he's unfamiliar with. The heroes approach the problem with all the tools of modern society, as well as a few that would have seemed like science fiction at the time, more on that in a second, but are thwarted, and is only by the addition of an impossibly competent polymath to the team who, while still being a man of science, his experience in Eastern Europe and the weird shit that happens there in this universe allows him to cast a wider net when theorizing, that they're able to figure out what's going on. Three. The technology used in his book are commonplace or antiquated today, but once you realize that at the end of the 19th century, things like typewriters, phonographs, train departure schedules, blood transfusions, and searchlights were either brand new or in a couple of cases not actually invented yet, you realize that our heroes are using cutting-edge tech to fight Dracula and are ultimately able to defeat him because of it. Blood transfusions have been shown to be possible, but hadn't gained widespread use because they wouldn't figure out blood types for a few years yet. The searchlight used to try to guide the Russian ship in had not been completed when Stoker began the book and only barely beat the novel's debut. Even rat terriers of the kind seen in the book would have been relatively novel and certainly wouldn't have been familiar to Dracula, so it was probably damn shocked at how quickly even one dog would have taken out those rats. It is even foreshadowed in the book when the wolf keeper refers to the wolves as low animals, being nothing to a good dog. Maggie, this is John's wife, would like to remind us all not to paint with too broad a brush as when we are looking at the width of the brushes from 100 years ago. As the Romani were only ethnic group that featured in the novel. There are Czechs and Slovaks in the early chapters with Harker, noted in the novel as being distinct from each other and even going so far as to accurately describe a dish from the region. Dracula appears to work with people from all three groups of people at different times, so the Romani inclusion at the end probably wasn't particularly meant as a slur against them, even though they were not treated well in general. Sturka may have been more sympathetic to them, having had experience in Ireland with a transient culture called Travelers. I could go on about how Dracula himself may have been based in part on Oscar Wilde. Interesting. But we should probably record one of our own shows one of these days. Again, we really enjoyed the episode and look forward to future installments. Well, maybe not the Iliad one. Sincerely, Jonathan Schaefer-Hames of Married with Content with John and Maggie podcast, as well as the Transformers Chronicles podcast. That was an outstanding email. I have nothing to add to it. What about you?
I took offense at the last thing they said.
Well, the episode dropped as the recording today. Let's see what people think about it.
Tisk.
So as people are passing judgment upon you for the Iliad, as well as going over and listening to our episode and then digging even deeper with your Dear Reader season, which I would like to plug again.
Oh, thanks.
You are going to foist upon us another work of literature for January. What are we reading in the dead of winter here?
Yeah, Dangerous Liaisons.
Really?
Yes. Well, no, could you imagine? That's foreshadowing. I had nothing until an hour ago or so, an hour and a half. I was wondering if I should pull something that's nonfiction that would talk about democracy in America, and wasn't sure if I felt like that. And then I thought of Kazuo Ishiguro, and I thought, oh gosh, that's a little too much. So, and I was thinking, oh, YA, what could we do? Is it Divergent time? No. So I am going to do a YA, and I really liked this YA, and I think it's also good because it is representing a people that we have yet to look at. And so I think this would be good in this current state of our nation to use empathy as we're reading. So we're going to read Other Words for Home by Jasmine Wargo.
All right. So come back in a month for that. Until then, thank you very much for listening. Take care and have a very happy holiday season, whether you celebrate Christmas or not.
Yeah, but hopefully you get a fruitcake from Tom and I. We've been making them diligently, sending them out to all our listeners.
Use it as a doorstop.
Ooh.
Good night.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by two true freaks. That's two true freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.